So as the candidates, their campaign staffs, the national media, and everyone leaves the snowy, frozen, rocky slopes of New Hampshire to head to the sunny south, we welcome you to this edition of Political Rewind. We're live in the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Midtown Atlanta. Boy, do we have a lot to talk about. New Hampshire sure went out with a bang last night. Here to talk about it, Jim Galloway, our friend and a colleague from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's their political writer, and he oversees Political Insider, the daily blog that tells you hour to hour what's going on at the Capitol. We welcome back Buddy Darden. It's been a while since he's been here. He's a former Democratic congressman from Cobb County. Thanks for being here, Buddy.
Glad to be back. Brian
Robinson. You're here today. I'm glad you are. He's former Deputy Chief of Staff, Communications Director for Governor Nathan Deal. Brian always has a lot to say about what's happening in politics. And because the lion really can sit down with the lamb, Senator Vincent Fort, a Democrat from Atlanta, is here. And I say that because there were days when Brian and his old job and Vincent Fort went at each other tooth and nail. It's very nice to see you actually sitting next to each other in our studio.
And with a senator sitting to my right, I might say.
for the last time, I'll always make sure I'm on your left.
Buddy?
May I ask, who is a lion and who is a lamb?
Well, that's right. You know, I leave that
I'm always the victim.
I leave that for everyone to decide. All right. So, look, we have an awful lot to talk about today. And obviously, New Hampshire gives us much to chew over, but to point out just how this campaign now is happening here in the South, Jeb Bush right now is in Mount Pleasant holding an event. He came down, or actually it's going on in a little while. He's already down here. Ted Cruz is in Myrtle Beach getting set to talk to people. Donald Trump tonight, where else would he be but at a big, big arena? He's at Clemson University. And John Kasich has been in Charleston, and he's heading over to Columbia later today. So Rubio is here, too, and he just released a list of military veterans who are part of his campaign committee. So Jim Galloway, we're it for the next few weeks.
Yesterday was Fat Tuesday. Today is Ash Wednesday. The fun's over.
All right. Go ahead.
No. This is where it gets serious. I mean, we've had our two display states, and now we get down to business.
Well, okay. So let's talk about last night. And because the Republicans are holding their primary in South Carolina on February 20th, Democrats don't go to South Carolina till the 27th. Let's start with the Republican campaign. Last night, and I'll start with you again, Jim, I don't know that it could have been a bigger night than it was for Trump. All the polls said he would win, but his victory was overwhelming.
Right, and of course, all of us were skeptical because there was in Iowa a difference, a 10% difference between what he was pulling at and how he finished. He finished a disappointing second, but in New Hampshire, he wasn't doing the right stuff. He wasn't shaking hands. He was moving from big event to big event, and yet it worked.
Yeah, you know, Brian Robinson, when Iowa was when the vote was the caucuses were over. People started talking about the lack of ground game that Trump had. And Trump actually said, well, I didn't even know what ground game was. I didn't understand that term.
Right.
Last night he made a point over and over again saying, what a ground game we had in New Hampshire.
Which is a hooey. He did not have a ground game in New
Hampshire. Right, exactly.
And I've always thought that the grassroots stuff was really overstated. The more media saturated we become, the less important door knocking and phone banking becomes. And he has capitalized on that change, I would say brilliantly. And he has almost undermined Bernie Sanders' argument about billionaires buying elections, even though Donald Trump is, in fact, a billionaire. He's had just spent no money. He has done this completely through earned media and has had a megaphone unlike anybody else, not even Jeb Bush, who has $100 million to spend. You know, Jeb Bush spent $40 million after up through Iowa, and didn't move the needle at all. So what you're seeing is that the entire dynamics of how these things play out has changed dramatically, and Donald Trump is on the cutting edge of it.
You know, buddy, 2 days ago, Trump got himself into a bit of trouble in denigrating Ted Cruz, and he used a word, a slang expression for the part of the female anatomy that people were really upset about because they talked about the coarsening of the dialogue and how dare Trump use what many people think is a sexist expression to talk about Cruz not being tough enough. So I want to play Trump just at the beginning of his speech last night to ask you, and I want you to jump in on this, Vincent. Are we going to start seeing a different Donald Trump? Here's how he started his victory speech last night.
So I want to thank everybody, but I really have to begin by paying homage to my parents, Mary and Fred. They're up there. They're looking down. They're saying, this is something very special. They love this country, and they're very, very happy right now. So thank you to my parents.
I don't know that I ever would have thought that Donald Trump would start a speech by acknowledging his parents and talking about them in heaven watching what happened.
No doubt about it. But going back just to a second about his encounter with the person in the audience who used a pejorative term towards Senator Cruz, if Senator Fort or I had done that when we were running for election, we would have been drummed out of office. But who but Donald Trump not only could get away with it, can be commended for it and gain votes because of it and come up with this astounding, what I think is an astounding result. I mean, the person closest to him was 15.8%, and he got 35.3%. Yeah. It's just, to me, I don't understand any politics, especially Republican politics, but this is just, I thought, off the charts.
You know, Bill, I think you're being a little bit optimistic when you postulate that Donald Trump may be softening. You remember coming out of Iowa, he made some statements and people said, well, he's softening and all of that. But then he comes up with this off-the-wall remark. So I think we shouldn't expect him to become a kinder and gentler Trump.
Well, and Jim Galloway, I don't think it would do him any good to be a kinder and gentler Trump.
Oh no, that would be contrary to his casting. No, but I will tell you one thing that did surprise me last night was John Kasich, the Ohio governor. He gave one of the more effective speeches of the night. He sounded in many ways downright evangelical, which is entirely proper since he was headed to South Carolina, I think.
Yeah, well, Kasich. Kasich does have a touch when it comes to appealing to the heart, doesn't he? I mean, he's always a guy. Jim, we saw him up in Cobb County a few months back, and when he talks about helping the needier people and so those the have-nots, he doesn't like it, Brian. But compassionate conservative, you know, comes to mind the old George W. days.
Which doesn't help Kasich at all
because
we Republicans hear compassionate conservative and we hear spend a lot of money, and that's exactly what we saw in the first term of George W. Bush. Kasich did really well with moderates and somewhat conservative voters. Got very little of the very conservative voters. No Republican nominee in my memory, I'm 40 years old, got to the nomination by winning moderate votes. There is no pathway for that. You do it by being able to straddle the line that Marco Rubio was trying to straddle, someone who could get the very conservative voters, but also mainstream Chamber of Commerce Republicans. So Kasich, I think, did a fantastic job in New Hampshire, had a really good debate last week, had an interesting speech last night. I agree with Jim. But beyond that, he's run a one-state campaign so far. And he doesn't have a lot of infrastructure in South Carolina, doesn't have a lot of money to really change the trajectory of the race. I think he's somebody who's going to end this campaign as the guy who finished second in New Hampshire.
Krista Lizza, who, of course, does the fix for the Washington Post, says that Kasich won't make it because he is the Democrats' favorite Republican.
Endorsed by the New York Times and the Boston Globe. I mean, nobody wants that in a primary. You know, like please don't endorse me.
All right, so let's talk about you've already started the conversation.
It's like being Vincent Fort's favorite Republican.
Vice versa. It wouldn't help.
On the show on Friday, one of you, Muggy, one of our panelists, said this reminded him of the Hosea Williams, what Hosea Williams used to say to his friends who were running for office. I will come in and either endorse you or say that I'm against you, depending on which works better.
Yeah.
But so, all right. So, Jim, do we assume that Trump takes this incredible momentum and comes into South Carolina with pretty strong
a favorite bet
to be the winner
down
there?
I think so. I mean, 2 weeks ago after Iowa, I would have said no. I think Cruz would be your better bet. But Cruz finished a kind of a tepid third in New Hampshire. I don't think he tried very hard. But I think Trump has got what Brian was talking about. He doesn't have just voters. He's got fans.
Yeah. I think third place for Cruz in New Hampshire was very strong for him, and it sets him up well going into much more favorable ground in the South. I think that he could really run the tables and roll up some big numbers on the SEC primary. If I am a Republican operative, and Cruz is not my candidate, but if I am an operative, I want to be on Ted Cruz's team right now because I think he is best situated. You know, Trump got almost 40%, even one with college-educated voters. That's amazing. I mean, I was sort of shocked by how well he did across the board. Won women. But I do believe that his ceiling is somewhere below 40%. And eventually we're going to clear the field. And I still think there's going to be somebody we coalesce behind.
Everybody thinks Trump's got a ceiling and he keeps exceeding it, you know? I mean, it's really.
But no, it's not that he exceeds his ceiling, but how are you going to take him down? I dispute that we're going to have people start leaving the race. I was a little bit unplugged this afternoon. I don't think Chris Christie is gone
well,
yet.
Well, I think Christie has pretty well announced that he's going to
South Carolina event. He's
canceled all his events in South Carolina. But you know what, buddy? Here's what's interesting about South Carolina, Brian suggests that Cruz is well positioned in the South. Certainly in Georgia, he's got a big ground game. We have a huge evangelical Republican voting base here. But South Carolina evangelicals are a little bit strangely more diverse than they were in Iowa, and they are here in Georgia. And they could be splitting up their votes. I don't think Ted Cruz can count on the evangelical community in South Carolina the way he might in Georgia and did in Iowa.
I agree that they are not in lockstep, and I'm not sure where they're going. Of course, the Bob Jones University crowd seems to have always be on the right side of things. But I do want to mention one thing I saw from South Carolina just a few moments ago watching CNN over at the Varsity, and that is Marco Rubio has not got his groove. He, I think, took on water, as you know, in the debate last week. And the great irony here is that the wound was inflicted by, of all people, Chris Christie, who went down, but he seemed to have taken Marco Rubio down with him, and he may have well inflicted a mortal blow on Rubio.
So let's talk about that. So do we agree that the two lanes, the outsider lane and the establishment lane, in the outsider lane, Cruz and Trump will continue, obviously, to compete for the nomination among the outsiders, Vincent Fort?
Yeah, absolutely. They're making an emotional connection, you know, harkening back to what Brian said earlier. You know, ground game or air game, you've got to make an emotional connection with voters. Cruz and Trump have done that. I think Bernie Sanders has done that. And that emotional connection is carrying them a long way.
Okay, so Brian Robinson, to the dismay of many Republicans in the establishment lane, you gotta wish that maybe there'd be some winnowing of the field. New Hampshire did not in any way provide that. You've got Bush still feeling competitive.
And with money.
And with money. You've got Rubio, who had a bad weekend and a bad day yesterday, but still feels he is competitive. You got Kasich coming in second, so he still thinks he might go. I mean, nobody got eliminated except maybe Christie, maybe Fiorina. We'll see what she decides to do. Maybe Ben Carson, right?
I think Carson's done. I don't. He didn't even show up at his party last night. You gotta love that, you know. I mean, that's some chutzpah there.
He was so eager to get south.
I'd say, if you had talked to me on last Friday, as opposed to today, my view on this would be so tremendously different than it is this morning. Rubio, after Iowa, was set to be the coalition candidate that we all got behind. I tweeted that out, actually, after Iowa. Okay, we know who our guy is. Let's all get behind him. And then Saturday night really changed his trajectory. It shows you how much New Hampshire voters tune in. And many in the exit polls said that the debate was a major factor for them, and they decided in the last few days. So Rubio, if he had finished third or second, would have really done some damage to the rest of the field. And what happened Saturday night gave life to everyone else. And it's going to make it harder and longer to get rid of Trump.
And I think Christie did such damage that damage is nigh on permanent, I think. The boy in the bubble is going to follow him for the rest of this year.
So, first of all, I'm glad you mentioned Twitter, because I should tell our listeners that we are now tweeting. We finally are tweeting from this show at PoliticsGPB. PoliticsGPB. Tweet us throughout the show today, and we'll, you know, some of you might, we might use some of your tweets on the radio. Okay, so let's continue with Rubio for a couple of minutes here. Jim, I thought last night, ironically, Marco Rubio, accused of being the robot candidate, being a guy who's an empty suit, had in defeat one of his most authentic moments ever on the campaign trail. Let's listen.
Our team here in New Hampshire did a phenomenal job. You worked incredibly hard, and I'm grateful to you. Now, we're still watching these numbers. We'll see where it winds up. But I can just tell you, I know many people disappointed. I'm disappointed with tonight. I want you to understand. But I want you to understand something. I want you to understand something. Our disappointment tonight is not on you. It's on me. It's on me. I did not do well on Saturday night. So listen to this. That will never happen again.
Yeah, I would give Rubio a break and, you know, quote Mark Twain, the reports of his death may be overstated. I mean, he has enough time, I think, to come back and to come back stronger. He damaged himself on Saturday, or Christie damaged him pretty well. But I think it may be premature to assign him to the ash heap.
On the other hand, we do have a debate coming up on Saturday, correct?
Yeah.
And I think Saturday's going to be really big for Rubio, make or break. I am of the school of thought that you get one flub, you don't get two.
Okay, but
I agree with that.
All right, but I think Rubio is in a little bit of a bind in terms of how he decides he's going to present himself in that debate. If he tries too hard to work on talking points, to have answers to anticipate questions and to put together his argument, he's going to fall. He has the potential to fall back into that trap of being pre-programmed. He's got to figure out something harder: how to appear spontaneous after all that happened to him last Saturday
night.
And
you're going to see Jeb Bush come after him, I think, on this one. Without Chris Christie won't be on the stage.
For what it's worth, I mean, Jeb Bush is just not good at going on the attack. I mean, and I'm a huge Jeb Bush fan. I would love for him to be president of the United States. He's brilliant, and he's saying a lot of the right things. But he's just not good in that atmosphere.
Well, now hold on. Because we know it's really interesting that the establishment candidates are starting to really take each other on today. And interestingly enough, it's Bush and Kasich who have begun to emerge as the real combatants with one another. And when you say Bush doesn't know how to throw a punch, let's listen to what he said this morning on MSNBC.
Well, he has nothing going on down here, best we can tell. He had a one-state strategy, and it was effective, and I commend him for the campaign he ran in New Hampshire. John's a good man. He's served as governor of the state of Ohio. He's done a good job. But he's not as conservative as me, and his record is not nearly as good as mine. And the one telling thing that he did, apart from not being, you know, not really focusing on rebuilding the military, which I think is important down here and in our country, is that when he had a chance, he expanded Obamacare through Medicaid.
So, buddy, there's Jeb Bush starting to lay out his attack on Kasich. And, of course, one of the things that he will emphasize down here is he thinks he's Kasich's stand on the military, expanding the military, is going to hurt him in South Carolina.
This is what we call faint praise, which, as you well know, is even worse than condemning someone because of the way he handled it, which I thought was fairly adroit. And incidentally, I think Bush ought to do well in South Carolina. He's got the structure to do it and the money.
All right. Kasich is not going to be a punching bag. Here's Kasich on Bush.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, the Bush campaign spent they raised like $115 million. They spent like $50 million in New Hampshire. They couldn't work with a positive message, so they just go negative, 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 and distorting negative. You know, I'm sort of, you know, as Arnold Schwarzenegger once told me about negative campaigns, he said, John, love the beatings. So I do love the beatings. But the fact is the Bush campaign can't figure out what it's for. And a candidate can't seem to know what he's for, so they spend all their time bashing somebody else.
Love the beatings. I told you it was Ash Wednesday.
I don't know what that means.
Well, what Kasich went on to say in at least one other interview is he's not going to be a punching bag for anybody. He said, I will fight back. But it is interesting, I think, that we're now seeing the Kasich-Bush fight emerge. And at least for the time being, none of those other mainstream guys seem to think Rubio. They need to go after Rubio at this point, at least. Right, Brian?
I always say people shoot forwards, not backwards. So if they're shooting at you, it means they think that you are a major threat. And the turning of the attention away from Rubio tells us that internally in Kasich and Bush world, they think that Rubio has been hobbled, perhaps crippled permanently, or they're going to start going after him again. But you know what I meant with Bush on the, going on the attack, that was actually one of the best attack deliveries I've ever seen him give. Because in the debates with Trump through the fall, he always looked like the kid who was getting bullied and his mama told him to stand up to the bullies with humor, and they always look like giant nerds when they do it. And that's what Bush looked like. He looked like a giant nerd trying to stand up to the school bully. And it just didn't work.
So, buddy, we have said, we are continuing to emphasize how important the March 1st primary is, first South Carolina on February 20th, and then March 1st here in other southern states. Clearly important, especially, well, really, Democrats and Republicans, because we're going to talk about Democrats after the break. But with Kasich continuing to be a viable candidate, suddenly the Republicans are facing just their worst case scenario, which is Kasich may not do well down here, but now he's going to look forward to the Midwestern states. He'll look at trying to rebuild in Michigan, for example. This is exactly what Republicans hoped not to have to deal with.
But this is the way it's supposed to work. We ought to have input from everybody on these races as to who the nominee is. In fact, I think we owe a special debt of gratitude to Secretary of State Brian Kemp for this SEC primary, because this is going to be a big deal because, frankly speaking, Georgia has been totally ignored in the past when it came to selecting the nominees.
Do we think, Jim, that Jeb Bush has the opportunity to really come back? So many people have said the guy just isn't going anywhere.
I think he does. I mean, it's not going to be a clean return, I think. I mean, a lot of people are going to have to crack before that happens. You're going to have both Donald Trump and Ted Cruz crack.
Vincent Fort, Jeb does think that South Carolina could be good for him. The Bush family has done well there. And he's got an awful lot of official support here in the state of Georgia, elected officials.
Yeah, I was more I'm more optimistic about Rubio being able to make a comeback than I am with Bush. His performance or his mediocre performances in debates and responding to Trump, you know, he just didn't look a giant nerd is not presidential.
Well, I will tell you one thing. I mean, look at Florida. Watch. I mean, Florida is just going to be an epic battle between the two because I don't think either one will get out before the 15th.
But Bush has not been polling well in Florida at all, which is a really bad indicator for him. Again, I love Jeb Bush. I think he has got one of the greatest arguments for why he should be president that is out there. And I have a real soft spot for him, even if he does come across as a nerd in those debates. But there are several things that we need to look at. One, he spent more than anybody else and has hardly moved the needle. More than 50% of Republican voters have said and have said all along they will never even consider him because of his last name, largely. And I think that those things are really tough. And look at how little oxygen he's going to be given. He got 48 seconds for his speech last night on Fox News Channel. 48 seconds.
And then Donald Trump stepped on him.
And then Trump stepped on him. That's what it is. He's sitting there gasping for oxygen, and then somebody steps on his neck.
All right. So just to show that we're not all so somber and serious here, you talk about Bush and how hard it's going to be for him to get any traction. His brother, George W., cut a spot for him that's airing right now in South Carolina because, again, George W. was, remember, George W. saved himself in races down in South Carolina. We're not going to play the Jeb Bush commercial. We're going to play Jimmy Kimmel's take on the Jeb Bush commercial that George W. cut on behalf of his brother. Here he is.
America needs help. Parents can't put food on their families, and our children still isn't learning. I know Jeb. I know his good heart. It's inside his body, next to other things, like his stomach, which is where his snacks go. I know that. And I know that experience and judgment count in the Oval Office, which is the room where the president works at his desk. That's where my little brother would work if he were president. Which, well, don't bet on it, but don't misunderestimate Jeb either. He's got a cute little wife, and he's a good little guy. And he knows how to open doors for America.
Great stuff.
Classic.
I had not heard that.
Classic.
Yeah, well, we had to have a little fun with this. I'll tell you what, we got a lot more to talk about, including the fact that the evangelist Franklin Graham has been down at the state capitol. He had a rally at noon. Jim Galloway says the AJC's people down there report that at least 3,500 people showed up to hear Franklin Graham. We'll get to that later in the show. We're going to talk about the other huge night, Bernie Sanders just tromping all over Hillary Clinton. But let's take a break first. You're listening to Political Rewind. It's 2:33 in the afternoon.
On the next Fresh Air, Zach Galifianakis talks about his new FX comedy series, Baskets, which he co-created with Louis C.K. Galifianakis co-starred in the Hangover movies and Birdman. And the writing, directing, and producing duo Jay and Mark Duplass talk about their HBO series, Togetherness. Mark co-stars in Togetherness. Jay co-stars in Transparent. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on your GPB station.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're joined today by Buddy Darden, Brian Robinson, Vincent Fort, and Jim Galloway. All right, Vincent, let me start with you.
Sure.
Am I right? You've endorsed Hillary Clinton, right?
Yes,
I know
have.
Buddy has, and we'll give him a chance, too.
Right.
I don't know how you can underestimate the damage that Bernie Sanders did to Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire yesterday, unless you somehow believe it's an anomaly and that when she turns south and goes forward beyond New Hampshire, everything will be fine. I just think it was an enormous loss, yes?
Yeah, the latter point you made has been the conventional wisdom that after Iowa, New Hampshire, the Clinton train will head south and the firewall of South Carolina, Georgia, and other southern states will save her. If Bernie Sanders comes to Georgia or another southern state, South Carolina, and gets, he doesn't have to win, but if he gets close in Georgia or South Carolina, and what I mean by close is, let's say, within 10 points, the damage, and I, as you said, I am a Hillary supporter. I would be very comfortable if either of them were the nominee. But if Bernie gets within a certain margin, that does not augur well for the Clinton team.
Yeah, Buddy, tell me your take on this. Because, you know, the thinking was she might get, if she got within single digits in New Hampshire, the expectation was Sanders will win. But she didn't come anywhere close to that. And doesn't it play into the scenario that this is unfortunately a candidate who people just don't take to and like?
She got clobbered. Now, I didn't expect her to get beat that badly. I thought that she might bring it up within 10 points. But, I mean, to get beat like she did by more than 60% of the vote, and she didn't even break 40, that's bad. I think part of it might be the same problem Jeb Bush has. Maybe there's some Clinton fatigue out there, just like there's some Bush fatigue. But on the other hand, if she doesn't do well in South Carolina and she gets some very negative results, and again, as Senator Ford has said, she's got to do well in South Carolina. She just can't afford to win by 51-49. Mm-hmm. And if Bernie Sanders is coming that close, that means that she has problems as a candidate.
Before we move on with more about Clinton and Sanders, let's listen to just a very brief moment of Clinton last night.
I still love New Hampshire, and I always will. And here's what we're going to do. Now we take this campaign to the entire country. We're going to fight for every vote in every state. We're going to fight for real solutions that make a real difference in people's lives.
Jim, for a candidate who some people think has credibility problems, I'm not sure I believe Hillary Clinton still loves New Hampshire.
No, but you heard her say they know they have to go after Bernie Sanders right now, right this very minute, before he gets any more momentum. And what you heard Hillary say was that we're going to go into every state, not just the SEC primary on March 1st. But, I mean, there's a whole host of other states. You have Alaska, you have Colorado, you have Minnesota, you have Massachusetts. And they have to open up fronts in each one of those states so that Bernie can't match them. You do see Sanders already working here in Georgia trying to crack the Clinton grip on African-American votes. He's got a next Wednesday, the 16th, he will be at Morehouse College. It's part of an historically black college and university tour that he's making. He's going after the college vote there.
He met with Al Sharpton in New York.
Yes, he
right
did.
Coming out of New Hampshire, flew to New York to meet with Reverend Al for breakfast this morning. Does Bernie Sanders, Vincent Fort, in your estimation, have an opportunity here to have his message resonate with African Americans in Georgia?
I think, you know, he does. The fact is, 2, 3, 4 months ago, who would have thought that Bernie Sanders would be beating the strongest Democratic machine in in the last 40 years? So I think he does. But I just want to talk about this issue of emotional connection. I think it's more than Clinton fever or, you know, people being tired of the Clintons. Bernie Sanders has been able, up to this point, to connect with people. It is very surprising that Hillary Clinton has not been able to as much. As you would have, she's lost Democratic women.
Yeah, and that, I mean, you've said an important thing. I mean, first of all, the exit polls in New Hampshire were even more devastating, perhaps, than the margin of her loss. She lost the women's vote to Bernie Sanders. That's devastating for Hillary Clinton. Before we get away from you, though, Vincent Fort, are you sticking with Hillary Clinton?
I am sticking with Hillary Clinton. Although, let me say this, some of the comments that were made by the Clinton team about Bernie Sanders over the last week or two, I was really concerned about those kind of comments.
Say he'd end Obamacare.
Obamacare, and then the criticisms of young women who were supporting him. I think that kind of attack, I think the Clinton team thought it would get them within a few points. I think they had an opportunity. I think those kind of comments don't help amongst Democrats.
Well, let me point out that Madeleine Albright owes her appointment to Hillary Clinton. In fact, Bill Clinton, and this is from an unimpeachable source that told me this several years ago, had already promised the Secretary of State to George Mitchell and then had to relinquish back up on that promise because he was trying to get back back in Hillary's good graces. So that was a Hillary appointment. So I understand Madeleine Albright's very, very strong feeling. But what I also want to point out is what really troubles Senator Fort and what troubles me, as I guess you'd have to call me an establishment Democrat.
Absolutely.
Is that at this point, I still consider Bernie Sanders nice fella, idealistic kind of fella, but I consider him as basically unelectable.
Well, I mean,
and I cannot ever see a scenario in which he can be elected president of the United States.
Sure, Brian.
I totally agree. He is unelectable, which is all the more damning for Hillary Clinton that she lost in such epic fashion to someone who has no chance, really, of ever becoming president of the United States. I don't see a scenario where Hillary Clinton is not the Democratic nominee, as much as I would love for Bernie Sanders to be and really, you know.
Donald Trump.
Yeah. Because, you know, for we Republicans who understand electoral college math, we have to be perfect to get to 270. The Democrats don't. They're almost there, you know, when Election Day starts. And Bernie gives us a real chance, and I hate to see us flub this opportunity. But again, Hillary is going to be their nominee. She's going into these Southern primaries that are majority African-American voters, and she's got tremendously strong polling numbers amongst African-Americans.
All right. Are you ready to be pinned down? Who is your Republican nominee who beats, presumably, Hillary Clinton?
I think Marco Rubio will bounce back from his debate performance. I think he will. I think he had a bad night. And I think he'll bounce back. And I think he's someone who can put Florida on the map and potentially could put Ohio on the map. And that's how Republicans have to approach this. No Republican has ever won without winning Ohio. And I think Rubio is one who can do it.
Jim, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't think we've ever had a Republican win the nomination who hasn't come in first or second in New Hampshire either.
Yeah.
That's true.
And that's what we're talking about here.
That's true.
Jim, one of the scenarios that's playing out, and we kind of referred to it, especially in talking about the exit polling, and we're going to discuss it more on Friday's show, the 3 o'clock show on Friday, because we will actually have women in the studio, which unfortunately we don't have today. This notion of Hillary Clinton's seeming belief, the fact that she seems to think she's owed women's votes. Madeleine Albright, Gloria Steinem reinforced that in their comments about her voters, about women abandoning her, and Madeleine Albright saying there's a special place in hell reserved for women who don't support Hillary. That's beginning to work against her and her campaign.
Right. And I think it's I think what Madeleine Albright was expressing, and Gloria Steinem too, was something that would be felt more of with women in my generation, and not buddies here, but not in where the competition and the rise to the top was a lot tougher. If you're a 20-something or 30-something year old, you're not anticipating that kind of fight, and so maybe it doesn't appeal to you. I think, look, to get back to what Senator Fort was saying about a direct emotional connection, you know, New Hampshire, I heard on one of the channels last night, was New Hampshire had the highest and greatest percentage of college loan debt of any state in the union, and that's what Bernie spoke to. I think that would appeal more to younger women than an appeal to gender, I think.
I think what is happening is that Hillary doesn't understand millennials and where millennials are. And because it's millennials who are crushed by that loan debt. And one of the things that I'm concerned about is that if Hillary Clinton alienates the base, you know, if she is identified with Wall Street, if she alienates millennials, in November, Democrats have to be concerned about folks not coming out. The lack of enthusiasm in our base would be a catastrophe. So, you know, I just hope that Bill and Hillary keep, you know, don't attack. You know, we don't need a circular firing squad.
No repeat of 2008.
I think she has proven herself to be a competent leader through the years, even though I disagree with her on many issues. But she is a terrible campaigner.
She can't connect.
She cannot connect, and it's even worse because her husband is the best at that of all time. You know, even Barack Obama, as charismatic and emotive as he was, he wasn't the, you know, going around the room hugging people the way Bill Clinton does. He didn't have that sort of interpersonal connection. Hillary doesn't connect. And I think she's a bad campaign manager. As David Axelrod, who spearheaded Obama's 08 run, said just this week, you know, if you're having campaign staff problems again and this keeps happening, maybe you're the problem.
Jim Galloway pointed out to us, we didn't know, he broke the news right in here in this studio, that Bill Clinton's coming to Atlanta on Saturday to campaign
for
his
wife. Yes, we don't have a time or a place, but I'm going to bet that it involves college students.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Buddy, quick note before we turn to state politics. First of all, we haven't listened to Bernie Sanders, and I want to play this only because, you know, Vincent, you talked about, here's a guy who's figured out how to connect emotionally with his audiences in a way that Hillary Clinton doesn't seem to have been able to. So let's just listen to a very brief, he gave an awfully long speech last night, but at the very beginning he talked about his upbringing. Let's listen.
My mom and dad and brother and I grew up in a small 3.5-room rent-controlled apartment in Brooklyn, New York. My mother, who died at a young age, always dreamed of moving out of that apartment, getting a home of her own, but she never realized that dream. The truth is that neither one of my parents could ever have dreamed that I would be here tonight, standing before you as a candidate for President of the United States.
Buddy, you have known... You've net known Hillary Clinton as a person. The people who know her in her personal life love her. They think she's a wonderful and caring friend. Why can't she do what a Bernie Sanders can do on the campaign trail? She did it a couple of times in New Hampshire in 2008 and rescued her campaign, but she seems not to be able to do that this time around.
You make a very good point. I've known her for almost 30 years, and to know her is to really like her and to really care about her and want her to see well. But somehow, just like Al Gore, if I might make this comparison, somehow something is lost in the translation when the campaign happens and the lights and the camera go on, and they seem to somehow become more withdrawn or guarded. And I think she has a certain amount of a personality situation where she is so guarded she won't come out and let her true feelings out, and so consequently she doesn't come across as a warm or sincere person always. And I think that's a shame, because to know her like I've known her over the years, she's a very warm person, very caring person, but somehow something is lost in translation.
All right, we got to take a break. There's some stories down your way, Vincent Ford, at the Capitol that are worth talking about. You're listening to Political Rewind at 2:49 in the afternoon. We'll be right back.
We'll look at the message out of New Hampshire's primaries and travel to Flint, Michigan, where citizens aren't sure whether they can believe what the government says about the water.
I don't know how you rebuild it, because trust is hard to rebuild after it's been broken. And that's in everything, so it's going to be hard.
Lead and distrust in Flint, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Jim Galloway is at the table. Vincent Fort, Senator Vincent Fort. Brian Robinson, former Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Nathan Deal. And our friend Buddy Darden, former Democratic Congressman from up in Cobb County way. Franklin Graham, the evangelical leader and son, of course, of Billy Graham, Jim, came to the state capitol today as part of what, a national effort to get evangelicals out to the polls?
Right. He's got a 50-state effort going on, and most of these states that he's going to right now are kind of coincidentally primary states. Yesterday he was in South Carolina, for instance. Today he was in Georgia. He had about 3,500 people over at Liberty Plaza across from the state capitol. A lot of emphasis on what he called the national moral failure of same-sex marriage.
We should say he has not endorsed a candidate and won't, right?
That's what he says.
Stay out of it. I have not heard yet what sound we got just in from our team in the field. Well, let's just listen for a minute, Jenny, and see what we got from Franklin Graham.
Secularism and communism are no different. They're the same. They're godless. And we have godless secularism in our state capitals. We have them in our communities all across this country, especially in Washington. You mention the name of Christ. You try to pray at a ball game. You try to lift up the name of Christ in any public forum, and what happens? The lawyers come and say, we're going to sue you. And so people begin to back up. People go, oh, I don't want to get sued. You know, let me tell you, get sued. Get sued.
Well, Vincent Fort, without trying to personalize this, mm-hmm. he was talking to you. He's playing, well, you know what I mean.
Yes,
look,
I do.
You've got, what, 9, 10 now bills, religious liberty bills down at, that you're debating down there at the General Assembly. And here's Franklin Graham with 3,500 people there, an army ready to come down on you all who are opposed to these bills.
Yeah, and I think he was unduly harsh. The gospel ought to be a little bit less confrontational. His father had a history of being putting a message across without being harsh. I'm a little bit taken aback by his attack on the state capitol as a secular place. I sit through the preacher
of the day every day. I can tell you, it's not a secular place.
But I understand what he's trying to do. It's pulpit politics of a sort that I'm very familiar
Brian,
with.
Brian, with all these religious liberty bills circulating downtown, how much impact can Franklin Graham's appearance today have on the legislature's acting on those bills? We've seen as you know, Josh McCoon has been blocked every year in his efforts. He's back. There are others. Is it changing down there? And could this help any of those bills go through?
I've rarely seen rallies have a tremendous impact on how the General Assembly works. Even in this situation where you had some real diehard true believers out there who I think are devoted Christians and good people standing out in 28-degree weather in high winds. It was unpleasant out there. I don't think that sort of stuff is going to move the needle too much in Senate and House committees, because we've seen how these issues play out in other states. They lead to boycotts. They lead to cancellation of conventions. It could lead to hundreds of millions of dollars in negative economic impact for the state. And that's why this has been stopped every year. It's not because people are against religious freedom. Everybody is for religious freedom, but religious freedom has to coexist alongside laws that ensure every person is treated equally and with dignity.
All right, I've got to do a transparency moment because we try very hard. You've now done. You're doing some government relations work. Are you involved in this fight with any of the business?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Okay, that's all. Yes, you don't have to say more. Just want to make sure that people know that you're working on this.
Absolutely.
Thank you for being transparent about that, buddy. Today, the House, in a pretty overwhelming vote, approved a measure that would the Georgia State High School Association. Does not allow athletes in this state to wear religious slogans on their uniforms. We incident with a cross-country runner who got disqualified for doing so. This bill essentially goes at GHSA and says any organization that doesn't allow that, this says you can't, the GHSA can't prevent their people from wearing it. It passed in a big way, right?
It passed in a big way in the House. bills like this, you have to. One thing to note is the GHSA is a very familiar punching bag in the Capitol because of course it controls ticket prices for all high school games. It
does classifications as to who is A and who's 6A.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So you do see some legislation launched against them. Generally, it has a way of going into a committee and just not finding its way out. So I'm not absolutely sure that this is going to get passed. I think it does send a message. Casey Cagle, the Lieutenant Governor, President of the Senate, he has spoken in favor of this kind of legislation.
It's important to note, though, that this only applies to state-sanctioned events. For example, if you want to have something on your back in a public race, the Peachtree Road race, or anything else, that's perfectly all right. This is just for high school functions sponsored by the Georgia High School Association. And the problem is, if you let people put certain Bible verses up on their headbands and so forth, what's going to keep someone who says, I love Satan, from putting his up there? Or praise Allah, be to God, and on and on and on. So I think the wisdom of the rule is pretty evident, and I think legislators in their wisdom will bury it somewhere in committee.
Yeah, your point, that those were the exact points that GHSA officials were making.
Buddy Darden, as long as you had the floor, I want to tell you, J.P. Cunningham tweeted us a few minutes ago, a listener at Politics GPB. He said, I've been crazy about Congressman Darden for 24 years. I still wish he were in public service. Time to announce for a re-election, for an election campaign.
I've had a wonderful career, and I appreciate Mr. Cunningham's attitude, right. But that's right. Not the prevailing one.
Jim, we're really running out of time. But there was an attempt down at the Capitol in the civil rights bill that would protect people here in the state, mirror the federal law in terms of race and religion, to add gender identity and gays and lesbians to the protection. The House leadership ganged up on that subcommittee and packed it to defeat that amendment. What does that tell us about their unwillingness?
And the next step was that it went to a full committee, and you had the more conservative element in the Republican Party try to sabotage it by barring discrimination in hiring and such. Then the leadership came back and said, no, we don't want that either. So the only thing that was added was, I think, a classification that would prohibit discrimination against on the basis of sex.
Sex. And there's already an effort, before it goes to the floor, to find out what that means precisely. There are some who interpret that to mean that that is a protection for gays and lesbians. If it is, this is Beth Beskin who added this, if it is, there'll be a fight over that on the floor,
and,
right?
And even if it isn't, what this bill would do, it would serve as a platform for the LGBT community to come back, you know, in future sessions to make adjustments to the legislation.
All right. We are completely out of time. Buddy Darden, Brian Robinson, Vincent Ford, Jim Galloway, what a pleasure to have you all here for this conversation as the South begins to take center stage in the presidential election. We'll be back Friday at 3 o'clock. Remember, Politics GPB is our Twitter handle. Why don't you go there right now? You can see some of the other tweets that came into us during the show. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks so much for being with us. See you Friday afternoon.